You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. We are visiting with Jennifer Knapp. Jennifer is a contemporary Christian artist, recording artist, and she is also author of the new book, Facing the Music, My Story. And we're very pleased to have Jennifer join us from Nashville, Tennessee. Jennifer, thank you for being with us. Now, Jennifer, as I mentioned, you are a recording artist, and you've done a lot of music. And when contemporary Christian music, as I mentioned to you, I did my graduate research on that, and it was barely coming out. And I guess the Jesus music, or whatever you want to call it, of the 70s, 80s, wasn't really that good. But then once people like you entered into the scene and recording labels started realizing that this was good music, it kind of took off. So tell us a little bit about your experience when you first entered the music scene.
To be honest, when I first started my music career, I had no idea about the history or the legacy of contemporary Christian music. I mean, for me, it was just a process of, you know, I was writing songs about my experience in life. And that particular experience that I was writing about at that point in time was my experience with my faith and with my Christian community around me. And so that kind of led to a discovery, I guess, if you will, of that whole big wide world. I mean, I honestly had no idea that there were Christian radio stations and Christian labels and concert circuits and all this kind of stuff. So it was kind of this weird accident for me that, you know, in writing about my genuine story and writing about my genuine experience, that I found out there were other people out there doing the same thing. And, you know, obviously, on a very massive scale.
Now, would you agree that perhaps contemporary Christian music or Christian rock, there's a misconception about that? Because as you say, you were singing, writing about your life experiences, and that's basically what Christian music is about. A lot of people assume that every other word is going to be Jesus or God or Holy Spirit, but it's music about life.
Well, you know, I think there are two sides to the coin. There are pressures within that industry. There has to be, at least at some point, and pardon my language for it, but a consumer confidence. I mean, obviously, if you're going to sign up to be a Christian music artist, there has to be some assurance that you know what you're talking about, right?
Right.
That you're actually writing from a legitimate place. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the absolutely irreverent South Park episode where Cartman decides he's going to be a Christian music artist. He just turns, you know, really seedy love songs and adds Jesus into the mix, and all of a sudden he's got a Christian hit on his hands. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. There, like I said, there's a real strong pull for everybody there to kind of be in on what it means to kind of identify with this Christian language. But at the same time, I think that's part of the success, in particular in the 90s and the early 2000s, of the culture that I would tell you that I was a part of at that time, was the Christian experience. What did it mean when we had our, you know, this life-changing experience with faith, and to have that show up in our music? But, you know, then you circle back around when you're talking about a marketplace that wants to be identifiable, you know, by these labels that we create. I am a Christian, and what does that mean? It's really hard to share that when there's a diverse group of people, so people come at that with a lot of meaning.
I think what you're talking about, and when I was doing my research, I found a lot of resistance from fundamentalists, traditionalists, who said, you know, this is the devil's music. It's not music. And as Michael W. Smith said, this is music for the other 6 days of the week. You know, Sunday you may have your hymns, your praise music, but this is music for the other 6 days of the week. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, I suppose it's one way to look at it. I would tell you, you know, one of the things I always struggled with when I was writing just for Christian music was, you know, my life is my life. You know, whether it turns out cheery or whether any difficulty I'm going through or any experience I'm having at the time that I want to write about, if the obligation is for me to have to deliver it like I would at a Sunday morning pulpit, doesn't always work. I mean, sometimes life is gritty and nasty, and yet, you know, as a person of faith, my faith does interplay in that, even on Monday or Tuesday and Wednesday, you know, and so it's, I think that's a little bit of the history of Christian music to faith communities. But even as much as there's been a struggle inside of faith communities to understand the music for, in the way that Smitty said, the other 6 days a week, there's also a misunderstanding from outside looking in that, you know, the second that you talk about your faith, that you're obligated to do that to make more Christians. And I think that's a little bit just a short selling. Spirituality is part of our lives, and some of us approach that from a very faith-based and a very Christian ideal. But it's not necessarily, for me as an artist, I always get really uncomfortable with the idea that that we're going to do this music just to make more Christians. And that's where, you know, for me and Christian music, that's where I personally ended up having to part ways.
One of the things, and we'll get to your book in just a minute, is the fact that some, not all, some of the Christian fans are, I guess, very judgmental, and they expect you to stay on a certain road, period. You know, if you're just playing Christian music, that doesn't mean you just go to a Christian barber, you go to Christian restaurants, you go to, sure. You know, everything's Christian. And Amy Grant, who was one of the ones who, I guess, opened the door for everybody and crossed over to mainstream, she was criticized heavily for that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that it's not just Christians that do this. I mean, it is a prevailing theme that you see occur in Christian environments where, you know, there's a real pressure to let everything you do speak toward your spiritual experience, as if in some way that if we do a better job of that, if we wear, you know, what would Jesus do bracelets, and everybody obviously knows all this stuff, then they'll see how good of a Christian you are. And that's a bit of a characterization. But I think what's important is to kind of step back and look at that this is something that we do as a human trait. Like, anytime somebody doesn't quite match up in our group, we start to criticize that person as not being authentic to that group because they might be a little bit different. I mean, I grew up in Kansas. All my friends around me were listening to pop music and top 40 radio, yet I grew up on country music. And they would make fun of me for, you know, knowing every word to Johnny Cash or to wear my cowboy boots to school because that's what my family did. Yet everyone around me would make fun of me for that thing and then tell me that I somehow wasn't cool or kind of break me down. It's a very human trait, and we see that acted out in faith-based communities as well. We want the people around us to reflect some part of the things that we're buying into, and I don't mean to downplay that at all. It's just that sometimes we start comparing ourselves and judging the people around us, and it's no different inside a faith community. And so I would say, you know, it's time to challenge ourselves a little bit. Yeah, you know, everybody that comes to church comes in with a lot of different things, a lot of different experiences. And to be able to have a safe environment to do that, part of one of the challenges I think that we have is to learn how to get along. I see that inside of LGBT issues as well. You know, that the same happens for me. When I go to mainstream LGBT environment and somebody finds out I'm a person of faith, they let me have it. They're like, you know, how can you do that? And, you know, because I'm a little bit different and odd in some places. So to be able to get comfortable and know how to walk around that and bring those in gracefully is, I think, part of the joy of being able to talk about any of this.
We are visiting with recording artist Jennifer Knapp. She is the author of the book, Facing the Music, My Story. Jennifer, your book is fascinating. It's a great read, but unfortunately, it's also tragic because of what you had to go through, what you went through. And let's start a little bit at the beginning with you growing up as a little girl, and then your parents divorced. You were with your daddy, and he remarried. However, you had issues with your stepmother, or rather, she had issues with you.
Yeah, we didn't get along too well. I mean, it's kind of laugh at it a little bit. It's my own experience, so I don't necessarily label it as tragic as some people do. But, you know, it was kind of like this Cinderella story. It just never really quite merged. And it's really hard sometimes to adopt, in a sense, people around us that we weren't born with and born into. So we definitely struggled with that. And as a young child, that was definitely hard for me to figure out how to manage when somebody had a hard time adding me into their lives. It was hard to not take that personally and not have that affect the way I viewed the world and the way I viewed myself worthy of being loved. And the value of telling that in this story for me is that it really set up a lot of the basis for the things that were to come for me in my life. Yeah, that was hard. It reminds us to not give up on ourselves. At some point in time, we're lucky we can survive those hard moments and be able to move on to greener pastures a little bit in other places that afford us in the ways that we really need.
One of the interesting points that I found out is when you're writing about your diary, and I guess your stepmother found it, she told your daddy, you're dad punished you or grounded you, but at the same time, he was very empathetic and he bought you something. Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, in that story, is this, you know, like this, what seems like a tragedy, right? Of somebody reading my private thoughts in my journal, and then the complex environment that I was in, my dad had to kind of punish me for having done that because it displeased and upset the family unit. But at the same time, he found a way for me to continue writing, and he got me this basically a little padlock safe that I could keep in the secret nook to be able to go and put those writings. So even though on one hand it was like a mixed message, you know, it took years to kind of look back on that episode. And I'm not sure what I would have done in his same position. I know that he loved me very much and was caught in the middle of a dynamic that was really hard to navigate. And I think sometimes those moments call for a very, very strong dose of grace to figure out, you know, how is anyone supposed to get through that kind of conflict? And we, you know, whatever desperate ways that we have to be able to love in between that, and is all the more important to do what we can. And so, you know, I could look back on that situation and say it was really bad, but it's also one of the moments in time that I looked at going, wow, to nurture the story that we have, to be able to nurture the cries of our heart, are sometimes really faint, but you can take that moment and plant a seed that can eventually grow into something really amazing. And, you know, who knows? If my dad hadn't taken that moment, I might have put down my pen, I might not have ever written again, and I might not have ever had the life that I have now and sharing the music that I do today.
We are speaking with Jennifer Knapp. She is the author of Facing the Music, My Story. If you are familiar with contemporary Christian music and some of the other music, Jennifer was a big contemporary Christian star back in the 80s, and she did various recordings with Margaret Becker and some of the other big names. But since then, she's coming out with a new album, and she has a new song called Remedy, and you can find that on the internet as well. It's a great song. Facing the Music is the name of her book. Let's get back to the book, Jennifer. Guide us through now as you're growing up. I don't want to give the whole story away, but as you're growing up, and then at what point did you discover music and the fact that you were able to sing, write, and record?
Yeah, you make it all sound like it was an easy and short thing.
No.
I started really falling in love with music in my teen years, you know, through just school and things around me. We had music classes and things like that. So it started out relatively simple, but I always was really moved by music. And in a lot of ways, in some of the more difficult portions of my life, I found music as a very good escape, a great place of solitude. And kind of parallel, but they hadn't quite intersected yet, I was learning to write as well. I would diary and journal a lot. It wasn't until I got into college and I began to participate, you know, actively in my faith community that those kinds of things began to marry up. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, I was part of an evangelical community that was very active in self-study and in self-improvement in regard of, you know, shaping ourselves to live in a very lifestyle-oriented manner about Christianity. And that involved a lot of Bible study, a lot of writing and prayer journals and things like that, and processing that, you know, getting to process some worship that through music. So those two things kind of started to collide with one another, and that led into what was eventually a Christian music career, much to my absolute amazement. I had no idea those things were going to intersect, and yet they did, and it was, you know, a radical adventure for the life, and it's affected my life even today.
People do not understand. They think, gosh, I wish I was a singer. I wish I was a recording artist. They have such a cool career, but it's a brutal life.
You know, it is. I don't want to take back from it. I really do have a blessed life. I mean, I think all of us kind of look for the work that we can do, the things that pay our bills that we also really actually love to get up and do every day. So I'm really grateful in that. But I think that the part of that that sometimes does get misunderstood is that, you know, like for me, I would tell you I'm an absolute introvert. I mean, I enjoy time to myself. I enjoy solitary time. And to go out and perform, it takes a lot of fuel and energy for me to do that, which, you know, I think is the false impression sometimes people get from creatives, is that we're hungry for attention and that, you know, all we want to do is be on stage so people will tell us how great we are. And I think that's not necessarily the path for everybody. I mean, for me, music is a part of self-expression that I would probably do, I'm sure I would do, even if nobody was looking. But I think that's kind of one of the amazing accidents of being able to tap into any of the gifts that we have. You know, maybe you knit or crochet, or maybe you're a poet or you're a really good cook. That's fine that you do those things for yourself, but it really starts to make an impact when you start to share those things with other people.
We are visiting with Jennifer Knapp. She is the author of Facing the Music, My Story. And the lead singer for Jars of Clay says, Jennifer's writing has ventured to the most vulnerable of places to offer us the story of a girl once broken in the throes of becoming whole. Now, when you decided to step out of Christian music, was that after you had come out and said that you were gay? Or was it afterwards because of pressure from the industry?
No, you know, to be honest, the entire time I was in the Christian music industry, I'd put my sexual person on hold. I mean, after I became a Christian, I was celibate. There was just no thought of that at all. So in that sense, I kind of became this asexual person. I just didn't view the world that way. I was busy doing God's work, for lack of a better way to say it. And it wasn't until I was just completely depleted. I was in my late 20s, and I just really needed to figure out who I was. I didn't have a life. I didn't have close personal relationships with anybody. There was a wall between me and the entire rest of the universe that was just put there for survival, and I was lonely and tired. So that was mostly a fair bit of why I had to just kind of step away from the spotlight for a good long while. And in doing that, that allowed me to be able to find a safe space to really ask the hard question. What kind of companionship do I need, and what is that? And that turned out to be that I was gay. So it's kind of funny, because gay people don't believe me that I was 27 years old and didn't grow up knowing that I was gay. It never occurred to me, really. It made sense to me after I kind of got in a line. It's like cogs in a wheel. Like, everything feels a little bit disjointed, but when you get them kind of lined up, everything starts to make sense, and it's better, well-oiled machine. And that's kind of was for me, but I always tease I was a relatively late bloomer, but all my friends were like, how did you not know? And I'm like, well, it took me a while. I had to get out. But some of those things are really hard to do in the spotlight. I can't imagine if that was something that I was having to wrestle with at the time. I probably wouldn't have. I don't even begin to know how I imagined it. So it took a long time of being away from the spotlight to be able to sort that out. And there was no way that I was going to be able to do that inside of a community that, you know, didn't wholly understand that. I had to figure out how to understand myself first.
We are visiting with Jennifer Knapp. She is the author of the book Facing the Music, My Story. Jennifer, towards the end of the book, you say, when I walked off the stage in 2002, leaving CCM and public life for what I truly believe was forever, I thought that I really could leave everything behind me. Every memory, the music, guitars, religion, good times and bad, all of it. If I could have erased my own mental hard drive, I would have. Instead, all I could hope for was to be forgotten in the public mind. Burn it all, I thought.
So dramatic.
Yes.
I think there's one of the things I was talking about recently with some friends is just that we put such a high value on being loved by others. You know, the impact that people praise us. I mean, we're all, as human beings, it's so important to get nourishment from outside. Our family, our friends can love us, hold us, and push us, keep us in their good stead. It matters what people around us say. But if you don't believe that, if you don't own that in yourself, kind of are comfortable with that, and that, I think that's indicative of where I was at that place in time. I mean, there was no amount, you know, you could have given me Grammy Awards and handed me checks for millions of dollars. It wasn't going to make an impact because I just didn't know what value I had unto myself. For anyone who ever thinks that that's a narcissistic idea, you know, it's really hard to kind of explain that self-nurture against humility. I mean, it's a really humbling process to go to those dark places where you're not obligated to succeed and perform well and have everyone praise you for how great you are, but to be able to look at that, look at yourself candidly and say, man, I like this about myself. I don't like this about myself. This is what I have to deal with, and what does that all mean? And at that point in time, I was just absolutely so desperate for it because I'd spent so much time kind of working toward an end of being something for somebody else that I didn't know who I was anymore, who the person I was authentically supposed to be.
We're visiting with Jennifer Knapp. She is the author of Facing the Music, My Story. Jennifer, after that, there were still a lot of contemporary Christian artists who came out in support of you, showed you their love, their forgiveness. And I guess that's one of the things that people struggle with, especially when they're not Christians or perhaps looking in, they're going, well, isn't Christianity based on love and forgiveness?
Yeah, you know, I think that's the easy place to start, and I think that's why it gets so vexing when we see, I think, what I would describe as religion taking precedent over the people that live it and experience it, the spirituality of the people that live it. I understand the context that there'll be a lot of theological arguments that kind of come into the fray here, but, you know, the one thing I always go back to is that we really can't avoid from the Christian perspective is that, you know, our charge is to love. To love God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so at some point in that, no matter all the rules that we think that will lead us up to that, sometimes the best thing to do is to stop making it so stinking complicated and just simply be kind and compassionate to our neighbors. Even if we don't understand, even if it's a long journey, You know, most of the people we meet on a daily basis have the book, you know, like I'm really fortunate. I had time to write it all down. But we have a whole life and a whole story behind the person that we meet in that 2 seconds. We can't always judge that book by our cover, but we can choose in that moment to be affirming of the person we see in front of us and get to know them. And I think that if there's any narrative that I would have about all this stuff that I've been through in the last few years, despite all controversy, despite any of the adversities that we come to, there's really no way getting around how quickly and swiftly people respond when you love them and hold them up and give them support.
We're visiting with Jennifer Knapp, author of Facing the Music, My Story. Jennifer, we have about a minute and a half left or so. Tell us a little bit about the music video that people can watch and listen, Remedy, and your new album that's coming out in next week on the 14th.
Yeah, I guess the place to start would be go to jenniferknapp.com. That's K-N-A-P-P. I've got a few videos up from the new record that are on there. The new record's called Set Me Free. The book, obviously, Facing the Music. You can get attached to Twitter and Facebook all through going to jenniferknapp.com. So anything that's fit to print, that's a great place to start.
We are visiting with Jennifer Knapp, author of Facing the Music, My Story. Jennifer, we're about wrapping it up here, but any plans to start touring?
Yeah, listen, you know, I'll be supporting a lot. I'll be doing lots of readings this fall for the book in support of the book, as well as going out and doing a few concerts. I think we're looking toward the spring of doing a fairly major tour. But, yeah, I'll be out and about all throughout this fall. So connecting to the website's a great way to stay connected. If you want, you can plug in there, and we could get your email from you and let you know when we're going to be in your area. So, yeah, lots going on, and I think I'm going to be a very busy girl in the coming months.
Jennifer, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us here today. We've been visiting with Jennifer Knapp, author of Facing the Music, My Story. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Louie. I really appreciate it.
Our line editor and producer for this episode is Belinda Fernandez. The producers wish to thank the AARP in Washington, D.C. for the use of the next two features, Movies for Grown-Ups and Primetime Postscript.
Here's Merv again. I'm Bill Newcott, and from AARP Studios, this is Movies for Grown-Ups. From 1965 to 1986, Merv Griffin hosted a daily talk show that featured generations of iconic figures in show business, art, and politics. Now an exhaustive new 12-disc DVD set presents the best of Merv, drawing from his vast archive. Merv died in 2007, but in 2006 we chatted about his show, and I asked him about his distinctive interview style, leaning close to his guests, staring them in the eye.
You know, I was never aware of that. When I'd lock eyes with them, when I would lean into them, I knew their eyes couldn't leave mine.
You were hypnotizing them. One of the touching things on it is the clip with John Wayne.
Isn't that touching? You mean when his little son grabs him and says, "You're my hero." And John couldn't handle that. He kept hitting him on the back like he was an adult, you know, going, "Oh, that's real. That's oh boy, that is really a nice thing to say."
And when you asked him if the Oscar was his greatest moment, and he said no.
No, I think it was the first time that John Ford brought a little cake in about that big around with one candle in it. And he said, "Duke, I want to congratulate you. You are a fine actor."
Yeah, they would open up. I never understood it either. But, boy, people would really talk about their lives. It's a matter of trust. They knew I wasn't there to bomb them. But I just wanted to hear how they got to where they are. Did you watch the Jack Benny one? He kept saying to me, "I am not funny. I am not funny. I'm surrounded by funny people, but I am not." And then that long take he did with me when I said,
"Do you remember your first laugh on a stage?"
And he just looked at me like, "Are you insane?" And he held that look, and of course, the audience laughter built until he finally said,
"That's the silliest question."
The 12-disc Merv Griffin Show from Reelin' in the Years Productions is on sale now. I'm Bill Newcott.
This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. John Muggy raises bison on his 35-acre ranch just north of Bellingham, Washington. He and his wife came into the business by chance in 1992. Now, as bison meat is becoming increasingly popular because of its health and environmental benefits, the Muggies can barely keep up with demand for their product. From Bellingham, Eilish O'Neill reports.
This first one is Junebug. She was bottle-fed. This is one of the 2-year-old bulls. These two here are on the butcher block.
Back in 1992, John Muggy and his wife decided they wanted to raise bison.
We wanted something to eat down the pasture stuff. we started with three bison, and just we're going to have pets, and a couple of years later, we end up being in the retail meat business.
The Muggies' 35-acre ranch has been in the family for over 100 years, and the couple has experience raising both horses and cattle. That said, bison can be a lot to handle, Muggy says.
Since we're both getting older and we're both we're retired, there might be a point here in the near future that we say, you know, this is a little more dangerous than we thought. You know, how many more times can I beat that bull or the 2-year-old to the gate before he gets there before I do, or something like that. But I think that majesticness of being part of something that was such an icon
has made the danger worth his while for more than 20 years, he says. Besides, he adds, bison meat is healthy. It's lower in fat and higher in iron than most red meats. And it's still tasty, according to Muggy, at least.
Basically, bison meat, the number one rule is lower and slower. Don't worry about seasoning the heck out of it. The natural meat has got a great flavor the way it is. We think it's a little bit of a sweeter meat than beef. We eat bison meat probably 3 times a day.
Bison meat is better for you than beef, and bison are also easier on the land than cattle. They leave ungrazed patches of grass, thereby creating habitat for grassland birds. Also, bison spend very little time by water, so they don't pollute streams and rivers much. Because of these health and environmental benefits, bison meat is becoming increasingly popular. Today, you can find it in some grocery stores and restaurants across the United States as a specialty item.
Mad Cow was the one that kind of took us to a whole different level. When Mad Cow came out,
it made everybody want to know where is, where does my product come from?
On Muggy's ATV, we head out to see his bison. It's high noon and hot, so most of the herd is in the shade of the trees at the pasture's edge. They're either wallowing in the dirt or just resting. A couple of young bulls run behind the ATV as it makes its way across the property. Muggy has a herd of 25 bison at the moment, though it sometimes grows to up to 35. Bison cows weigh about 1,000 pounds, while the bulls can weigh up to 2,000 pounds. Slaughtering one of the animals is quite the process.
Either I'll haul him to the butcher, or the butcher will come here and do what they call a modified farm kill, which is they're shot with a 30-30 in the skull.
Muggy says he doesn't just sell the meat. He tries to use everything.
We've processed our own hides. Every piece of the animal has got some use somewhere. I've sold foreleg bones to a dental lab in Kennewick, Washington. They use them to, when they make new dental tools, they use them to test them on that bone because it's slightly softer than our enamel.
Some say we should be preserving bison, not eating them. But John Muggy disagrees. He says it's thanks to ranchers that bison came back from the brink of extinction at the turn of the 20th century.
The comeback of the bison, it wasn't our government that did it. It wasn't the natives that saved them on their land or anything. If we didn't eat them, they wouldn't be here today.
John Muggy says he's doing his part to bring back the iconic North American species. For Primetime Radio, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Bellingham, Washington.
This has been the Primetime Postscript, made possible by AARP, and today, Eilish O'Neill. To hear more stories and postscripts, please visit aarp.org/radio.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.